to Day On Against the Grain. Why was Hannah Arendt so critical of Zionism? What did her objections have to do with how she viewed historical anti-Semitism and nationalism? I'm CS. Jonathan Grobart discusses his new book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Hannah Arendt, the influential thinker and author of books like The Origins of Totalitarianism and Eichmann in Jerusalem, combined a penetrating identification of Zionism's pathologies and promises, a sophisticated reading of Jewish and European history, and a comprehensive situating of Zionist politics within global political dynamics. So writes Jonathan Grobart, who in his new book fleshes out Arendt's understandings of historical anti-Semitism, of nationalisms, and of mainstream Zionism, which Arendt found deficient and in certain respects dangerous. Jonathan Grobart is professor of political science at San Diego State University. He's on the Academic Advisory Council of Jewish Voice for Peace. Jonathan's new book is Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. When Jonathan and I connected recently, I asked how much effort Arendt devoted to understanding how anti-Semitism manifested and unfolded in Europe.
This was a central focus for Arendt. Starting in the 1930s, as the Nazis take power in Germany, she wants to understand how this happened. So it was very personal to her, and because she is an intellectual, then she wants to understand the bigger picture. So even for kind of her magnum opus, Origins of Totalitarianism, the original inspiration for Origins of Totalitarianism is understanding anti-Semitism and the Jewish question more broadly. So it was really the feature of what inspires a number of her ideas down the road.
Tell us a little bit about why this was personal for her, maybe a little bit of background. Obviously, she had to migrate. She was forced to move. What happened such that the fate of the Jews, and she was a Jew, was so important to her, and understanding historically what happened in Europe was so important to her?
Well, in a personal experience, she recounts this in a later interview, is it was one thing to see the brown shirts, those who we would think of kind of the mob, expressing vicious anti-Semitic views. But she was in intellectual circles, right? She studied under Heidegger, and it devastated her less that the mob did it, which was still disconcerting, but that respectable intellectual society, in this case in Germany, could accept these views of racial supremacy and such an ugly version of nationalism. So I think one concrete element was Jews being excluded from German universities as the Nazis take power, and her advisor, who she highly esteemed, Heidegger, being part of that in the beginning. So that was one personal experience. Then she goes off to France to escape Nazi rule. And then when France is at war with Germany, before Germany successfully invades France, she's put in an internment camp where she's in this odd position where she can't count on Germany to advocate for her. But from the French perspective, she's a German national. So she finds herself at limbo as a Jewish person. So, and ultimately, it could have happened. She too could have been someone put off in the death camps. In a way, it's lucky that she was part of a group of people that, in that interim period, Frances surrendered to the Nazis, and it's unclear what to do with these French internment camps. She's part of a group that decides, all right, now's the time to leave while there's no one watching us. But others didn't, because they were understandably just very concerned about them getting caught. So she had that sense that this really could have happened to me. And then again, because she thinks as a broader public citizen, that to her the Jewish question also implicated fundamental questions of how do people get along, how to think about global justice, how to think about politics. So it was personal, and it's neatly integrated with her intellectual interest in the good society.
I want to go back in history, as she does in much of her writing. The way she approaches and tries to understand anti-Semitism in the centuries of European history before the Holocaust focused in part around her understanding of so-called court Jews, Jewish notables under monarchies, various monarchies in Europe. What role did they play in relation to early modern states that aren't found important?
For her, the court Jews, and who later become a broader category in her formulation of just the notables, are those that are not specifically aligned to the budding nation state, but have all these contacts and access to finances. So they take on a very functional role as essentially monarchs are trying to accumulate greater power. So they're trying, first and foremost, it's finances. Secondly, it's contacts across territories. Third, it's information. So the court Jews, because they have a combination of access to a good deal of financial assets, access to contacts across borders, sometimes based on Jewish family connections, and not having a personal stake in who wins power struggles within these budding modern states, they're very useful for a long stretch of period. And so that's her jumping off point for understanding the basis of how Jews are interacting with the broader European community and how they can be the eventual targets of hostility from those that are hostile toward the state, or at least toward the monarchy, and who then extend their hostility to the Jewish community writ large, not just the Jewish notables. So for her, that really is the essential jumping off point, the court Jews, and later they become the Jewish notables in her formulation.
Yeah, you're right that each social class that came into conflict with the state became anti-Semitic because Jews were the only social group that seemed to represent the state. And what did Arendt come to understand about the willingness of Jewish communities, including these Jewish elites, to participate in political and social issues, to engage with those kinds of issues?
Well, what Arendt understood is that the bulk of the Jewish community was not being politically engaged. For the elites, there was an obvious motivation not to be politically engaged, as they had a pretty good position. They had status, wealth, right? They had the favor of the monarch, and so certainly they don't want to get connected into political sides, political factions. She writes less about, say, the Jewish masses or even the Jewish middle class, but they too she saw as generally just being distrustful of outsiders. And so they too, in her, you know, it's an archetype, right? And she understands that this didn't apply to all Jews, but to Jews at large, this was a problem of not being engaged with the outside community. So this is something she laments that happened for several centuries. She sees the notables as being the primary instigators of being politically aloof. But what she's also urging is for the majority of the Jewish people, who certainly are not the Jewish notables, to get politically involved. And this is a dangerous situation, as she formulates, when they stay so aloof and unaware of just the intricacies, the specific political, social, economic developments that are taking place. So they end up poorly equipped to deal with the political tensions.
Jonathan Grobart is his name. He's professor of political science at San Diego State University. We are discussing his new book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. It's published by Temple University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You write that to further explain the evolution of anti-Semitism in Europe, Hannah Arendt considered the flourishing of two variants of nationalism in the late 18th and 19th centuries. One was rooted in the modern nation state. Jonathan, what was this kind of nationalism, and how did Arendt assess it, evaluate it?
This nationalism is what we might think of as the conventional nationalism. We'll associate it famously with France, is that the state would be linked toward a common national identity. So the idea was that all residents living in the territory of France would not just be part of a common political identity, but would feel part of the same people, whether it's the same language in particular of importance, religion, historical narratives. So that nationalism was the effort within a political territory to feel this broader common bonds. And so that she treats as of mixed developments. On the one hand, she welcomes the idea of some type of common identity. The problem is, particularly as migration is going to keep developing, is once you start getting a distinct national identity that's distinct from just your political identity as part of that state, you're opening up for tension. And certainly in times of unrest, in times of great migration, even this more appealing, more democratic nation state associated, say, with the French revolutionary tradition, has the seeds of creating hierarchy and discrimination.
Yeah, no doubt Arendt was worried about, concerned about the issue, the reality of statelessness. And I guess with, you know, nation states, then you determine who is the national, and then they're, of course, non-nationals, and they become vulnerable. The second variant of nationalism that very much concerned Arendt was tribal nationalism. So this is the sort of nationalism maybe we think of less than the conventional nationalism. What was tribal nationalism in Arendt's view, and what did she think of it?
So for Arendt, tribal nationalism was a natural outgrowth of multinational empires within, say, the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Russian Empire, that there were different national groups with distinct languages that were living in the same political territory, but already very tense. So there wasn't the basis for, say, developing a new common national identity, which was the idea, say, of France or Italy. So even, say, you know, the empire that includes Poland, I mean, there's what we would think of as Polish nationals, but within that there's Russians, there's Jews. And so it's these national groups that are living among each other, and there's, under tribal nationalism, the clamor is, can we have just our own land, say, just of Poles or just of Russians? And the sense that we can't possibly live, it's not as if we could all assimilate into a shared common national identity, which was at least the ideal of the conventional nation state. It was that we can't possibly live, say, with non-Polish nationals, or we can't live with non-Russian nationals, and so forth. Therefore, we both need our own territory, but endemic in it is ethnic cleansing of other national groups. So this is a far uglier phenomenon, tribal nationalism, that's even in times of relative stability, tribal nationalism is already groups that have just fundamental distrust within the political entity. So tribal nationalism to her is what's really is the central driving point of what leads to the Nazi ideology.
And what did Arendt think tribal nationalism did to the prevailing form of anti-Semitism? Did she see anti-Semitism changing in the face of this growing tide of tribal nationalisms?
Yes, tribal nationalism made both ethnic cleansing much easier to envision, but all the more importantly, eliminating another people. Treating another people as just not worthy, not even part of the same human race, as she pointed out. So once you get to tribal nationalism, then you got the trigger, not just for, say, keeping out others, and not just for general discrimination, but the sense that these are lower forms, making something like genocide readily imaginable. And so for Jews, they're particularly in this bad position because they are a very visible non-national group across particularly Central Europe.
At the conclusion of World War I, 9 new nation states were established in areas formerly controlled by Austria-Hungary, Russia, or Germany. What did Arendt think of this development?
Arendt was appalled by this development. To try to create new nation states where it meant that you would have a majority or maybe even a plurality national group. Like in the case of Poland, Polish nationals didn't even make up over 50%. They were a plurality, but not an absolute majority. And so you're having Poles, you know, those who identify as Polish nationals, Russian nationals in Poland, Jews, and an assortment of other national groups. So you're trying to, in Arendt's mind, they're trying to craft a situation that is just not consonant with the way people are living there. And you're then openly associating these new nation states as a state that's primarily part of that either majority or plurality nation. Yes, there's minority treaties that are meant to protect some of the minority groups, but even if they were working, that the minority rights to allow at least civil rights, they're still just making clear that you're at the sufferance of the dominant national group. So this is far worse than what at least was an historical, organic way of developing the national identity in countries like France and Italy, where over time a shared French and Italian identity. Here you're just right away saying, okay, this is now linked toward one of the national groups, or the dominant, the most numerous national group, and you're making it clear that there's a hierarchical division. you're going to try to smooth it over with some minority rights. But to her, this was a recipe for disaster.
And so you write that for Arendt, the dark side of the nation-state model fully emerged, you know, with this creation of the new nation-states after World War I, as governments withdrew their connection to a subset of the states of the nation-states' residents. Now, we haven't really talked about Hannah Arendt vis-a-vis the Zionist project, because we're laying a foundation, as you do in this book, of the kinds of ideas and insights she would draw on as she looked at the Zionist project, the Zionist movement, and tried to analyze it, tried to understand its promises and its perils. On the promises side, what did Arendt like about Zionism? What features of it did she like and appreciate?
What does she like about Zionism early on? So why does she identify as a Zionist starting in the early 1930s? She sees them as, here's a group as consciously Jewish that's acting politically, that's trying to create a new society, and that's calling for Jews to organize. It's a cross-class division. It's no longer the Jewish notables calling the shots. So there is that action they're taking as Jews that are exciting. The second part she likes about Zionism, really through the 40s also, is that there is this social justice idealist element. It's not that she was any kind of pure socialist, but going beyond the profit motive, taking on imperialism, and developing new participatory democratic structures, all that was very exciting to her about Zionism.
That's the voice of Jonathan Graubart, Graubart. He teaches political science at San Diego State University. He's on the Academic Advisory Council for both Jewish Voice for Peace and Open Hillel. He's the author of Legalizing Transnational Activism, The Struggle to Gain Social Change from NAFTA's Citizen Petitions. We are talking about his new book. It's called Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Arendt focused much of her critique on the mainstream tradition of Zionism, the Herzlian tradition, Herzlian referring to Theodor Herzl. To what extent did she see the Herzlian tradition as being associated with nationalism?
Yeah, so in short, she saw Herzlian nationalism as a version of tribal nationalism. So it's worse than just the nation-state identity. At least if it was the conventional nation-state identity, then in principle, this new entity of Palestine would have to be a shared national identity of all the residents. And even if it does envision expulsion of some, there would have to be at least a common new national identity of all residents. For tribal nationalism, and certainly this was very explicit for the mainstream Zionists, and so she conveniently links it to Herzl, is this element that Jews will only be oppressed elsewhere. So non-Jews you can never trust for very long. So the only place Jews can be secure is where they dominate. So this element, it's not that Herzlian Zionism treated non-Jews as a subspecies, so let's say she's not arguing it's as ugly as the Nazi German species of tribal nationalism, but it is still saying that there's no possibility for Jews to live over the years with non-Jews, without the non-Jews ultimately trying to do harm to the Jews. So the sense that Jews can only live in safety among their own people. So to her, that's a tribal nationalism in the sense of Jews can only live among themselves and no interest even engaging with non-Jews, because ultimately there's not much hope under the Herzlian version of Zionism, which was the mainstream version as she saw it.
Right, and there's no hope because Zionist tribal nationalism, in Arendt's view, was fixated on eternal anti-Semitism, which she said had become the common sentiment of the Jewish masses. What is eternal anti-Semitism?
Well, here's a way I frame it to students. There's that old movie, The Exorcist, from 1972, where Linda Blair plays the teenager who's possessed by a devil. And there's the young priest that lives there that, you know, knows the family well. But they bring in this old priest who's a specialist in doing exorcism. And when the young priest meets the young priest says to the old priest, you know, Father, I would like to give you the background of this situation, of the family history. And the old priest says, I don't need any background. The devil is the devil. And so for eternal anti-Semitism, I see it as analogous, is we don't need any background of who the players were. Whoever they are, they're going to just look for opportunities to do harm to Jews. So the eternal anti-Semitism goes hand in hand with tribal nationalism in arguing that it's just preordained in some kind of mystical fashion that non-Jews are going to look for opportunities. There may be some brief periods of peaceful times, but the orientation of doing harm to Jews will come back.
Yeah, and according to what you write, to Arendt's alarm, Zionists actually welcomed. It's not just that they thought, okay, well, there's this eternal anti-Semitism and that'll force us never to trust anyone other than Jews, and therefore, but also that they actually welcomed eternal anti-Semitism. Why?
Yeah, this is why Arendt likes to call it Herzlian anti-Semitism, not just because Theodor Herzl is the modern founder of Zionism, but because Herzl really did appeal to this idea that anti-Semitism is always there. And remarkably, Herzl sees it as a good thing when the anti-Semitism gets bad enough, because that will both shake up Jewish community to see that their only way out is forming their own state. But in so much as you can now just convince others, look, we'll get rid of your Jewish community. So whether it's the Ottoman Empire, the Brits later, we'll take care of your Jewish minority that really are alien outsiders. So it's a win-win. And so that element of Herzlian or mainstream Zionism, having this thing where anti-Semitism outside is a good thing in terms of being able to develop the political momentum for a Jewish state. And also, after the state is founded, when she's critical of Israel's trial of Eichmann, is that idea that here's the reason why we still need to keep promoting a Jewish state because of how bad anti-Semitism is elsewhere.
All right, now that we understand some of the features and contours of the eternal anti-Semitism mentality, why did or what did Hannah Arendt think of it, and why did she, frankly, reject it?
So what bothered her about eternal anti-Semitism is it kept Jewish communities stuck in place where it would be led by the Jewish notables. There'd be limited political engagements, and there'd be a cluelessness about what trends are taking place. If you just, in Arendt's mind, assumed an eternal anti-Semitism where it's just kind of the devil, it's just demonic, and didn't look at how anti-Semitism is a dynamic variable that's affected by external forces and also by internal forces, how the Jewish community interacts with the outside and how the Jewish community organizes itself internally, then eternal anti-Semitism is preventing any informed, productive Jewish response. So for in Aaron's mind, it's both a troubling negative consequence for the fate of the Jewish people, but also for the global community. It's getting in the way of a new, more just, more peaceful society that would benefit Jews and everyone else.
Yeah, so she saw the eternal anti-Semitism syndrome or belief as distinctly ahistorical, right?
Exactly.
And you write that with all Gentiles predisposed to hate Jews, Jews' destinies were seen as different than other nations, and therefore mainstream Zionist Jews were not inclined to engage with others. I wonder, if you have your book, can you turn to page 62 and read that last full paragraph?
Sure. In sum, Arendt berated the Zionist movement for updating the failings of Europe's Jewish communities instead of acting as a vanguard for a new emancipatory Jewish politics. Mainstream Zionists chose separation over engagement with the outside world. Similarly, just as Europe's Jewish notables bypassed the public and worked closely with governments, the Zionist leadership courted great powers as allies, not other oppressed groups. Summarizing her overall dismay, Arendt reflected on the, quote, spectacle of a national movement that started out with such an idealistic elan, sold out at the very first moment to the powers that be, that felt no solidarity with other oppressed peoples, and that endeavored, even in the morning dream of freedom and justice, to compromise with the most evil forces of our time by taking advantage of imperialistic interests, unquote.
Jonathan Grobart reading from his new book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. Martin Buber, who you also discuss in some detail and engage with in your new book, Buber believed that a just modus vivendi with Palestine's Arabs was the ultimate moral and political test of Zionism. Did Arendt agree with Buber on this?
She did. Unlike Buber, Arendt didn't pay as much attention to the specifics of how to develop Jewish, Arab empathy, solidarity in Palestine, but her bottom line was absolutely the same. For Arendt's perspective, the point is Jews need to engage with other groups, so particularly the oppressed. And so obviously, with the nature of Zionism going to Palestine, it followed from Arendt that it was essential to develop this modus vivendi with the Arabs of Palestine.
And how did Hannah Arendt see Zionists viewing Palestine's Arabs? What did she notice about that, and how did she critique it?
Well, she looked at it, I'd say, as two ways. One was the Jewish community bypassed the Arabs of Palestine altogether. This would be, as she thought too, a common imperialist pattern of outsiders just ignoring the indigenous and negotiating directly, in this case with the British imperialist overseers. The second element was adapting the eternal anti-Semitism now to the Arabs and the Palestinians of Arab in particular. That's, again, coexistence is not possible. They're non-Jews. Whatever else they want, they are going to look for opportunities to do harm to the Jews. So it was a combination of a standard European imperialist indifference, but then the added twist is this eternal anti-Semitism would also apply then toward the Arabs in Palestine and in the neighboring region.
And if under eternal anti-Semitism, Jews who adhere to that see themselves as surrounded by enemies, hostile enemies, implacably hostile enemies, then what did she see? Well, she saw a Jewish state guided by mainstream Zionists as becoming obsessed with defending itself, right? With defending itself from hostile forces.
Yeah, to her, this would just be a siege mentality. It'd be a Spartan state. So where the militarism element overwhelmed every other aspect of the society. It'd be a siege mentality.
And I imagine that siege mentality means that such a heavy priority is put on self-defense and militarism that other things vital to Jewish culture or just to universal culture would be ignored or deprioritized. And she lamented that, right?
She did. I'll just quickly read from the quote, the passage I quoted. She writes, "The land that would come into being would be something quite other than the dream of world Jewry, Zionists, and non-Zionists. The, quote, victorious, unquote, Jews would live surrounded by an entirely hostile Arab population, secluded inside ever-threatened borders, absorbed with physical self-defense to a degree that would submerge all other interests and activities. The growth of a Jewish culture would cease to be a concern of the whole people. Social experiments would have to be discarded as impractical luxuries."
Given Arendt's dislike, distaste for the conventional nation-state model, the idea of a homogeneous a nation-state, which often just wasn't the reality, how did Arendt think Jews should act vis-a-vis Palestine's Arabs? What did she think collaboration could or should result in? What was the end goal or maybe the fantasy in her mind of what Jews and Arabs could build together?
The end goal was an affirmative binational society. When I say affirmative, it meant that, yes, both the Jewish community and the Arab community in Palestine would have their distinct language, distinct cultural heritage. They would have their own educational, cultural practices and some internal political autonomy. But the affirmative part would be extensive engagements, so regular interaction over governing of, say, broader municipalities, broader cities, common security. So in this case, a binational federation that would have a place for distinct national identity, but for it to really break from a model that had been so disastrous, one needed institutional structures and an attitude where we are ultimately in this together. So the shared governance, the interaction is constant. So that was her ideal. So you wouldn't move to the point of just assimilating everyone to some kind of new generic Palestinian identity. The distinct national identities would be there, but it would be there in a way that would enable both distinct national identities to flourish, but affirmative, very active co-engagement of the communities, co-governance.
You write that Arendt's plea to find innovative modes of political organization, along the lines of what you were just discussing, remains imperative today for the prospects of both a just peace and a desirable Jewish homeland. Elaborate on that.
Okay, yeah, that's music to my ears about what's the appeal of Arendt now. Her dire warnings are all the more relevant now for anyone who follows the current state of Israel and Israeli political culture. It's far uglier than it was when she was writing, and the degree of tribal nationalism, siege mentality, the undermining of even conventional liberal democratic values are all at an all-time high. And What also remains is you have two very distinct national identities, say, across Israel-Palestine. You know, by Palestine, I mean the occupied Palestinian territories. But if we look at the region of the original Palestine Mandate, there really are two national groups with deep attachments to essentially the same territory. And so the idea of developing a imaginative political system that accommodates both distinct autonomy, cultural, language development, religious development of each people with affirmative, active joint governance remains essential. What form that takes specifically, you know, we'll wait to see, but that idea of some type of binational federation is essential. And I'd say it's essential, you know, for the Jewish community if one wants something other than a victor society. If one just wants a victor society, then, you know, the Israeli Jews are in pretty good shape. They still have an overwhelming economic, military advantage and political advantage in terms of U.S. support. But if one wants actually a decent society, then one is going to have to figure out some ways to institutionalize and develop a shared governance and a shared sense that we're both connected to all of it, and we need to start thinking of other kinds of institutions. The specific formal will not probably be the same as what she and others were proposing in the 1940s, but the element that one needs not a rigid separation of Jews and Palestinians, but a means where they can actively coexist, that remains essential. And that means imaginative new political structures.
That's the voice of Jonathan Grobart, again, Graubart, professor of political science at San Diego State University. His new book is Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And what about Israel stands vis-a-vis the international community? How would you evaluate that, and how would Arendt understand that in light of her analysis of what was happening with Zionism back in her time?
Arendt's problem with the way the prevailing Zionist political community treated internationalism was twofold. One, it was about courting imperialism, so looking for the support of the dominant powers for a Jewish state with the idea that we would be good for you. We would be good, say, originally for the Ottoman Empire, then later for the Brits, and later for the Americans. And the other element that she decried was the lack of regard, or even beyond that, the outright suspicion of any kind of deeper international governance, international community. Ben-Gurion famously remarked it was the beginning days of the State of Israel, so sometime late 40s, early 1950s, when the UN was brought up to him, he said, smoom, meaning that the Hebrew word for UN is meaning, you know, forget about the UN, we can't trust the international community. The international community is, in a sense, it's another element that's part of the eternal anti-Semitism. That's always going to be bad for the Jews, in this case, the State of Israel. And so to her, and this is part of her critique of Israel's trial in the Eichmann trial of 1961, is what's needed for human progress, which is also, of course, essential for the Jews, is a more just, a more cohesive international community. So it bothered her tremendously that the perspective of the mainstream Zionist was to oppose, to resist any kind of international involvement. The only international policy, according to Arendt, that the mainstream Zionist had was courting great powers.
How relevant is Arendt's critique of the nation-state system to today's world?
Well, the way I see it, it remains especially relevant for the many parts of the world where there continue to be distinct national identities living in the same political territory. So that would be true across, right? Much of the Middle East, certainly much of Africa, certainly big elements of Europe. It may be less important, say, you know, for the United States, perhaps for Western Northern Europe. Her predictions that the nation state would disappear in favor of either empire or her desired one of federalism was not borne out. But she's right that it remains a unresolved obstacle toward peaceful, just coexistence in many parts of the world, especially in the Middle East and including Israel, Palestine. So that bottom line, she's correct.
You refer to Hannah Arendt as a pariah. In fact, the subtitle of your book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, is Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. Arendt looked approvingly on a Jewish tradition of conscious pariahs. What did conscious pariahs do or believe, in her view? And why do you call Arendt the outstanding Jewish pariah?
Yeah, her full term was conscious pariahs, to make it clear that this was a thought-out ideology and not just being an instinctive contrarian. So for her, a pariah meant challenging oppressive structures both within your community and outside the community. For the Jewish pariah, certainly you would decry the anti-Semitism from the outside and the injustice from the outside, but you wouldn't stop there. You would look at the internal hierarchies, including, say, the Jewish notables. And so you would critique the hierarchy and oppression within the Jewish community. And that was a common feature, and certainly that's part of what goes on in her most controversial book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, is that she's ultimately identifying with the conscious pariahs that certainly were absolutely opposed, appalled, alarmed by Nazism and the cooperation of all these non-Jewish communities in the Holocaust, but also warning that the Jewish community and the Jewish notables often were not good for the Jewish community. And so the appeal to be a conscious pariah, to challenge injustice within one's community and outside the community, to her, that was essential. And so I call her the outstanding Jewish pariah because she frames it very well. And she's the first insider-outsider of a Zionist dissident, in that she both identifies with some aspirations of self-determination, so she never called herself anti-Zionist, but there is that element of sharp criticisms, in this case within the prevailing Zionist community, but also of the outside community. So being thoroughly dissident. And so it's that element of pariahs that she was outstanding within the Jewish community at a very critical time period.
Jonathan Grobart, we've talked about only a section of your new book, Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism. What else can people find within the covers of this book?
Well, there's both an historical part of recovering this dissenting anti-statist Zionist tradition that aren't hooked up with, that I call the humanist Zionists, that we're calling for the revival and flourishing of Jewish culture in Palestine, but insisting that it be part of a new society that featured a just coexistence with Palestinians. And then what the book does is look at how these ideas can be recovered through a dialogue with contemporary Jewish dissenters and certainly one outstanding Palestinian dissenter, Edward Said, to imagine a very different way of still expressing Jewish self-determination in a way that's not an either or. So it's not us versus them, but to frame it as a way of flourishing of one's own community and a just coexistence with another community that's geared toward a better society. So the ultimate appeal of this book is to reframe. That's why I call the book Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism. I'm still holding on to the idea of Jewish self-determination, including within, you know, the land of historical Palestine mandates, but thinking about it in a way that actually resonates with a broader vision of global justice and certainly with just coexistence with Palestinians.
The book is Jewish Self-Determination Beyond Zionism, Lessons from Hannah Arendt and Other Pariahs. The author, my guest, is Jonathan Grobart, professor of political science at San Diego State University. Jonathan, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, CS. This was quite a pleasure being on the show.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.